You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, "But They Keep Buying." Despite warnings from scientists about climate change and surging seas, the coastal home sales market remains strong in North Carolina. The cover story article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, "Drawing a Line in the Sand. Talk of Climate Change Does Little to Thwart Sales of Coastal Homes." And this is written by Caleb Harshberger. After years of slow growth following the financial crash of 2008, coastal realty companies and property owners are finally settling into a time of healthy markets and rising home prices. But as property values rise, researchers and scientists are becoming increasingly vocal about the growing risks of climate change and the impact rising sea levels are having on the North Carolina coast. Research by the First Street Foundation analyzing government data and property records estimates tens of thousands of properties are at risk and hundreds of millions of dollars in property value have already been lost due to rising sea levels on the coast. Meanwhile, researchers at universities across the state continue to raise concerns about the impact rising sea levels, a serious matter in a state with an extensive coastline and a long history as a destination for vacationing Americans. Basically, the 3,300 miles of our coast is eroding, Duke University professor Oren Pilkey says, some rapidly and some very slowly. Despite those warnings, sellers are having no trouble making buyers' dreams of beachfront properties come true, with many customers saying rising seas won't impact them in their lifetime. But protecting the coast and the beaches from rising sea levels is expensive. Those costs get distributed throughout the country, with many restoration efforts supported with federal and state tax dollars. Last year, for example, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers led a $10 million beach renourishment in Wrightsville Beach, with the cost shared by the federal government, state, and New Hanover County. Pilkey says this means coastal residents rarely feel the cost to restore the beaches, and he argues that if local communities had to shoulder the burden themselves, their approaches to rising tides would look quite different. One of the things that's happening more and more with beach nourishment is that the public is catching on that we're paying for it, Pilkey says. Real estate comes back. Rob Good, who has been selling real estate in Wilmington for 13 years, says sales are better than ever. Fresh out of Appalachian State University, Good moved to the coastal town and got his real estate license in 2006. Then the market crashed. "I got into it right before the downturn," Good says. "I was able to find a niche in the market." That niche was selling distressed and foreclosed homes as the recession swept up the market. A decade later, the market is finally back to about where it was before the crash. "It's definitely a lot better now," he says. Good says his customers increasingly come from out of state, and as remote work becomes more common, younger professionals can move to the coast and keep their jobs. "We see a lot of people moving here from all over," he says. "A lot of people are working from home now and don't have to be in the areas where they're moving from." Add a booming economy and an aging population, and the coastal real estate market has a lot working for it. Another Wilmington area realtor, Heather Black, credits the economy and a steady supply of people looking to invest in a second home with the improving market. Black, with Coldwell Banker Seacoast Advantage, says the market is doing well this year, with 2019 seeing a bump in sales prices and a drop in days on market since last June. Specifically, median sales prices have jumped 8% since last year, according to MLS data for the Brunswick, New Hanover, and Pender counties, and days on the market went down from 90 to 60 days. The number of sales dropped slightly. In Dare County, 30-year Outer Banks real estate veteran Jeff Scott owns Scott Team Realty, based in Southern Shores, and has worked in the market for three decades. "It's significantly less sales than it was, say, in 2004 and 2005, but that market was overheated and unsustainable," he says. "This market is good because it's a solid demand and it's not out of control. Still, growth has been uneven." In 2005, everybody was surprised at how high the values had gotten. In 2013, when they were reassessed, the total value of Dare County real estate went down about 29%, he said. Have we come back? Some areas have come back strongly. Others are not there yet. Another longtime realtor, Daphne Benning, co-founder of Ocracoke Lightship Realty, says this is the best it has been in a long time. This is the first time the pace is, for us, borderline brisk, she says. Climate costs. What's also brisk is the growing concerns from scientists and researchers about the risks of rising sea levels and the impact it will have. Dukes Pilkey says the more experts learn about climate change, the more they're concerned. Along the coast, a recent study by scientists at the First Street Foundation, which analyzes flood risk, found 81,908 properties in North Carolina are at risk due to rising sea levels. First Street Foundation studied property records and compared them with data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the National Weather Service, and other government and academic data. According to its findings, North Carolina has already lost an estimated $582 million in property value from 2005 to 2017. Starting in Miami, the group calculated the impact of rising sea levels on property value since 2005 and projected the cost over the next 15 years. They then began analyzing properties up the coast, recently reaching up to New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. An interactive visualization of the group's findings can be found at floodiq.com. Pilkey says it's important to remember that the coastal areas of the state are flat. That means small sea level rise, in theory, will produce large shoreline retreat, he says. Additionally, much of the area infrastructure and roads are at a lower elevation than the homes, Pilkey says, putting added strain on communities and residents during floods or storms. And it's not only shoreline retreat that's causing issues. Communities are increasingly dealing with rising groundwaters threatening infrastructure, such as roads and septic systems, says Jessica Whitehead, Chief Resiliency Officer at the new North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency. If not addressed, she says failures of septic systems could lead to major health concerns. There are impacts of sea level rise long before you see rising tides, she says. Changing climate solutions. Solutions to the rising seas are varied, and even those who agree with the research often disagree on the best way to address it. The Center for Climate Integrity, an initiative by the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development, recently mapped the cost and number of miles it would take to protect the coast of North Carolina from the effects of climate change with seawalls. The state was the third most costly in the nation. By 2040, the study showed the coast would need 5,250 miles of seawalls, costing around $34.8 billion. If this was not done, researchers said the coast would be faced with the impossible choice between drastic cuts to infrastructure, education, and healthcare, or major retreat from at-risk areas. Still, not everyone agrees that seawalls are the best ways to address the rising tides. Dukes Pilkey advocates beach renewal and the gradual beginning of retreat from the retracting shoreline. He says in many cases, seawalls may do more harm than good, bouncing waves back against the shoreline, doing little to stop the erosion of the beaches. Our main response is beach nourishment, he says. Communities throughout the coast are already hard at work resupplying their beaches, often with the help of state and federal funding. But each round of beach nourishment is just a temporary solution, Pilkey says. A nourished beach will last on average 3 years, he says. It depends on how big the beaches are, how big the storms are. In other states with smaller waves, such as Florida, nourished beaches can last up to 7 years. Also, it's expensive, with a mile of beach renourishment sometimes costing millions of dollars. Some researchers have suggested it could be more cost-effective in certain situations to simply let the coast retreat and move or demolish at-risk buildings in its wake. A Western Carolina University study analyzed properties in North Topsail Beach and compared the cost of purchasing at-risk properties to the cost of continuing beach protection initiatives, increasing area maintenance, and lost tax revenue. In the strongly worded study, researchers said purchasing and clearing those properties would cost $54.8 million with inflation, but save the town $57.6 million over 30 years. a total savings of around $2.8 million. The study exhorts coastal communities to study which areas can be saved and to consolidate efforts there rather than trying to save the whole coast from rising tides, something the authors say would be expensive and unsustainable. Pilkey agrees that retreat will be needed as seas continue to rise. It's not going to be a solution much longer, he says. We are going to have to start some large-scale moving back of buildings. Some communities have already begun, he says. Additionally, the state's Whitehead says competition for federal funding support is getting increasingly hard to come by as more and more communities across the country compete for dollars. Beach renourishment is working right now. Whether it will work in the long term will be a challenge, she says. All of the beaches throughout the East Coast, the West Coast, the Gulf Coast, all need beach renourishment. Out of sight, out of mind. Asked why so many buyers seem to have little concern or no concern for the warnings of researchers and climate scientists, many said it simply doesn't feel tangible. It's not as obvious to the naked eye, but I think people are conscious of it, Ocracoast Benink says. It's not to say global warming isn't there, and it's definitely real, but it's not terribly tangible for us yet. Additionally, she says much of the property on Ocracoke is away from the shoreline, so residents and visitors rarely experience the rising tides. Benink says she's had one investor ask her about divesting due to the rising tide, but few others have expressed similar concerns. Additionally, with much of the costs associated with coastal restoration and protection supported by state and federal dollars, the cost to residents isn't much of a hardship. In Wilmington, Good says the price they pay is manageable and has been built into taxes. And as far as rising tides, he says, people who are buying oceanfront don't have that kind of concern. They don't worry about it. They don't think it'll happen in their lifetime. In Dare County, Scott says he's had customers express concern about the rising tides, with some even choosing not to buy property on the beach, but not enough for him to notice a shift in the market. There's a handful of people each year who are very worried about it and think they should get property here at a discount, or they're just too scared to buy something, he says. I don't see it impacting my business at this point. If they're too concerned, Scott says a beach house may not be the right choice for them. To me, if you're lying awake at night worrying about your beach house, you probably shouldn't have a beach house, he said. And there are people I have to say that to for numerous reasons. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Krispy Kreme adds new look and a New York location. Krispy Kreme has long been a favorite of North Carolinians, and the iconic brand is looking to make moves to add some zest back to its performance. On July 23, the donut maker unveiled a new store concept in Concord, the first redesign in more than a decade. Krispy Kreme is looking to add 45 stores across the country through next year. Earlier this summer, Krispy Kreme announced that Times Square is going to be hot now. Krispy Kreme will open a high-profile store in the iconic New York location in early 2020. The plan is a 4,500-square-foot store at the corner of 48th Street and Broadway and will include a 15-foot-tall hot light. Krispy Kreme is beloved in North Carolina but has had some bumpy paths. The company went public in 2000 at $21 per share and began an aggressive expansion. That met with mixed success, and Germany's JAB Holding Company acquired the company in 2016 for $1.35 billion. JAB Holding is controlled by the billionaire Ryman family. Krispy Kreme has effectively shifted its headquarters from Winston-Salem to Charlotte, as CEO Mike Tattersfield is now based in Charlotte. East Carolina joins the beekeeping craze. East Carolina University is getting on board with a trend buzzing around college campuses, becoming the 77th school to have a certified Bee Campus USA program. ECU will join more than 150 other cities and campuses around the country in the Bee Campus and Bee City programs. Both programs are initiatives of the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, a nonprofit based in Portland, Oregon. East Carolina and UNC Chapel Hill are the only public universities in the state with the designation. College students, faculty, administrators, and staff have long been among the nation's most stalwart champions for sustainable environmental practices, said Griffin Avon, East Carolina's chief sustainability officer. We are very proud to continue this tradition here at ECU and lead by example in becoming the next Bee Campus USA. The program is designed to marshal the strengths of campuses for pollinators by providing a healthy habitat, rich in a variety of native plants, and free of pesticides. Canes general manager honored for stellar season. It was a big year for the Carolina Hurricanes and a big night for the team's general manager. On July 24, the team's corporate supporters held a celebration for Don Waddell, the team's president and general manager. He added the title of general manager in 2018 after new owner Tom Dunnan removed Ron Francis. Waddell revamped the team, trading key players and putting a young, energetic team on the ice with new coach Rod Brind'Amour. The Canes made a thrilling run to the Eastern Conference Finals, and Waddell was a finalist for General Manager of the Year. The celebration, hosted by Align, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, PNC, Syneos Health, and UNC Rex Healthcare, was held at the Bridge Club on Hargett Street in downtown Raleigh. PR queen now looking to connect through her art. In the media world, she was known as the PR queen, and Rebecca Antonelli would do anything to make sure that if reporters needed a quote, her clients would fulfill those wishes. She would coordinate photo shoots and interviews on deadline to make it convenient for journalists, and her clients thought of her as the rainmaker. All that is behind Antonelli now. After 25 years in public relations, she has immersed herself in art, creating abstract, acrylic, mixed media, and transitional art. "We are all artists at birth," she says. "Sometimes our creativity is stunted or not nurtured, but it is never too late to access the powerful healing qualities of art." A sample of her collection is on display at Margot's Restaurant in Raleigh and will travel across the state in the next few months, Antonelli says. ALS Association to relaunch popular Ice Bucket Challenge. Given the heat, bringing back the Ice Bucket Challenge sounds like a brilliant idea. 5 years after videos of individuals dumping buckets of ice on their heads went viral, the organization that benefited from the charitable and comedic efforts of thousands online is looking to relaunch the challenge. Starting in late July, the staff of the ALS Association North Carolina chapter will launch the Ice Bucket Challenge in an effort to raise more funding and awareness. In 2014, when the challenge first gained popularity, the ALS Society raised more than $15 million in association with the online phenomenon. And finally, holy hot rod, here's a car finally worthy of Biz. Here at Biz, we're tired of walking in our 10-car garage, picking out the same gullwing Mercedes or turbocharged Porsche 911, and then cruising Glenwood Avenue to the office at TBJ. It's just time for something more exciting. So we perked up at news that a Batmobile is up for auction July 31 through August 3rd in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The vehicle dates from 1966 and includes a V8 engine and gasp, a photo of Adam West in the car. With the car. It even includes a bat phone, which can come in handy since Chief O'Hara is lousy at texting. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Technology, Banking, and Transportation page, written by Lauren Onasorge. Another bank eyes landing talent from Square One. For the second time this year, a big bank has snagged a team of former Square One bankers to get into the venture banking game. Stifel Financial Corporation, a financial services giant in St. Louis, has announced the launch of its own venture banking and lending business. Tapped to lead the unit are Brad Ellis and Nathaniel Stone. Ellis, the unit's managing director, and Stone, named a director, are both veterans of Durham-based Square One. Matthew Wagner, CEO of Pacific West Bancorp, the Los Angeles entity that bought Square One 3 years ago, did not return a call for comment on the move, which follows Signature Bank of New York's hire of several of its Durham and Denver team members. Ellis was managing director at Square One Bank, responsible for the firm's New York region. Stone was a senior lender at Square One, also in New York, and they're bringing with them a team of other Square One vets, including at least two based in Durham. Brock Vandervliet, an analyst with UBS covering Signature Bank of New York, said he is not surprised to see more institutions betting big on venture banking. Vandervliet, who does not cover Stifel or PacWest directly, notes that interest rate changes put more banks under earnings pressure in what's already an extremely competitive industry. With rates going higher, they're looking for ways to out-earn and outgrow the competition, and the venture banking area appears to be perceived by a number of banks as a fruitful opportunity, he says. Because much of these loans are secured by capital draws from limited partners, there's very little credit risk, so you're kind of able to get something for nothing. Fast growth, nice spreads, but without an overhang of a lot of credit risk. And as traditional banks build their teams, they're looking at the banks with a history of success in the venture banking area, specifically Square One Bank and Silicon Valley Bank. Valencell lures its new CFO from Red Hat Tower. Raleigh-based wearables and innovator Valencell has a new chief financial officer, and she comes straight from Red Hat Tower. Christine O'Shea, previously vice president of finance at Red Hat, says IBM's $34 billion buyout of the open-source software firm had nothing to do with her departure. Just from a personal perspective, this is a great opportunity in my career path, she says, noting that Valencell is growing in an exciting arena. As we look at the overall marketplace around consumer wearables as well as medical-grade devices, I think we have a great opportunity. Amazon's Garner Hub, now expected to open in 2020. Towering over Jones Sausage Road in Garner, a massive structure waits to open as Amazon adds some final exterior touches. Initially, the distribution hub, announced nearly a year ago, was targeted for a fall opening. But Joseph Stallings, economic development director for the town of Garner, now says 2020 is more realistic amid the more than $5 million in road improvements attached to the project, primarily paid for by the state. And there's still a lot of work to be done on the inside with the internal operations of the facility, he says. An Amazon spokeswoman said in an email that timing is still unannounced and declined to confirm an opening time frame. The site that once held ConAgra's Slim Jim plant, which shuttered after a deadly explosion in 2009, is expected to create 1,500 Amazon jobs. It's a $200 million, four-story, 2.6 million square foot investment, officials have said. June is yet another record month for RDU. Traffic keeps growing at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. CEO Michael Landguth said RDU broke an all-time enplanement record in the month of June, enplaning more than 679,000 people, a 10.6% increase. At the July Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority meeting, he called out Delta Airlines, the airport's largest carrier partner, as a supporter of its growth. Delta has more than doubled its service in RDU since 2010 with 20 additional destinations, he said, pointing to a recently announced nonstop flight to Jacksonville, Florida, as one example of that continued commitment. But with growth comes expensive growing pains, he said. The airport is in the early stages of adding another two checkpoint lanes to combat long lines at Terminal 2, but the airport configuration would make expanding past 14 lanes tough. RDU is exploring its options as the passenger count continues to rise. As of June 30, more than 3.4 million passengers had boarded planes at RDU, a 9.6% increase over last year. And of those flyers, more than 104,000 were traveling internationally. That's a 20.7% increase over a year ago. Increases in investment by carriers helped drive the numbers, such as Spirit Airlines' debut earlier this year. And along with this article, here's a list called Flying High. Here's which airlines grew the most in 2019 as of June 30. Number one, Frontier Airlines, 78%. Two, Air Canada, 11.7%. Three, Delta Airlines, 7.4%. Four, United Airlines, 6.6%. Five, Southwest Airlines, 6.2%. Six, JetBlue, 3.3%. 7. American Airlines, 1%. And finally, number 8, Alaska Airlines, 0.8%. Now we turn to On Healthcare and Education, written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. Hatteras Ventures-backed firm adds fresh round of capital. Hatteras Ventures Partners has taken big risks in seed-level investing on early-stage life sciences companies, but it looks to be paying off, at least for now. Trefoil Therapeutics of California has announced a $28 million Series A led by Bios Partners. The company, which is developing treatments for serious corneal endothelial diseases, and epithelial disorders was the target of an early-stage investment by Hatteras, which put $4 million into the company. Hatteras did participate in the newest series, but the firm has not disclosed the amount of their newest investment. The new funding will allow Trefoil to put its lead candidate, designed to reverse vision loss by stimulating cell proliferation and migration, through phase 2A trials. Christy Schaefer, general partner at Hatteras, says the move reinforces the firm's earlier interest. Trefoil continues to validate this model that investing in early-stage science, although seems as risky, can really pay off when you get the right team, the right science, good board members, and fund enough to get them through key experiments, she says. Schaefer compares the investment to Hatteras' early stake into Research Triangle Park-based G1 Therapeutics, which plans to submit a new drug application to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2020 for patients with small cell lung cancer. Schaefer says in the case of both G1 and Trefoil, Hatteras took interest because of the academic and scientific expertise bolstering the companies, which they believe outweighed risk of largely unproven drug candidates. We felt like we had the ability to come in a very early way, accelerate the opportunity, both from the financial perspective and a scientific and clinical development standpoint, she says. But Trefoil's lead candidate is still far from commercialization. Hemp manufacturer partners with Las Vegas firm. A fast-growing triangle material science company has partnered with a Nevada cannabis company to launch a new line of cannabinoidal CBD products. Root Bioscience of Morrisville announced a partnership with Jerome Baker Designs of Las Vegas that Root's CEO says will accelerate the company's revenue projections. Root began less than a year ago with $2 million from early investors, including former Burt's Bees CEO John Replogle and One Better Ventures CEO Garrett Perdue says the company is processing more than 1,000 pounds of hemp per day, and the new deal could raise revenue projections for this year to well beyond $10 million. We do contract manufacturing for a number of entities, but this is the time we've done it on a very large scale, he says. So it's key to Root Biosciences. The ability to help other brands deliver really high-quality products into the market has been fundamental to our business model since day one. This is total validation to that approach. NC's largest mental health provider expands business. Months after being acquired by a private equity firm, North Carolina's largest behavioral health provider has expanded the network's clinical research line of business. The move comes after Carolina Partners in Mental Health Care, or CPMH, was acquired by River City's Capital Funds in September. At that time, the company said it would aggressively seek to expand its footprint across the state, building its presence in markets such as Charlotte and Winston-Salem. As part of the acquisition, Jeff Williams was named CEO. He is the former CEO of Morrisville contract research organization, Clinipace. Williams is using his experience in clinical research to expand a secondary line of revenue, partnering with Eligo Health Research, a Texas-based clinical research organization that he says will expand availability of services and treatments to CPMH patients. I saw just an incredible amount of potential to build our clinical site business inside of Carolina Partners, he says. However, to do it right, you need a certain amount of infrastructure, a certain amount of resources dedicated to building a center of excellence. UNC research to research impact of social media, fake news. As social media becomes a dominant source of news and information, new funding will allow UNC Chapel Hill to study the impacts of the growing cultural phenomenon. UNC has received more than $6 million to research digital information and its effect on culture. UNC was one of a handful of universities to receive $5 million from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation of Miami. The funding, plus $750,000 from Luminate and $600,000 from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, will fund the new Center for Information, Technology, and Public Life, or CITAP, C-I-T-A-P. Gary Marcioni, Dean of UNC School of Information and Library Science and Principal Investigator for CTAP, says this is a way to really jumpstart a big research effort that will lead to enhancement of classes related to social media, impact of information, and data in our world. And finally, Precision Bio raises profile in Durham. Coming out of the company's debut on the public market, One Triangle Company is doubling down on its investments throughout the triangle. Precision Biosciences pulled together $130 million during its initial public offering, or IPO, in March, as well as another $50 million credit agreement in May. The biotechnology company is working to develop its ARCUS genome editing platform, and the funding has the company on a runway to drug development into 2021, CEO Matthew Cain says. He says the company will shift its focus to development of cancer immunotherapy treatments first, while phasing in gene therapy candidates in the coming years. Cain says by the end of 2020, the firm expects to have as many as 4 chimeric antigen receptors, or CAR, T-cell therapeutics developing, with at least 3 in clinical trials. The company reported just $10.8 million in revenue last year through partnerships with other companies using its technology. He says the company's path toward profitability is aimed at leveraging drug companies, not by looking for more licensing deals. "Certainly, we will look at additional partnerships as we go forward," Cain says, "but that is not our primary focus or intent. There will be opportunities, but that is not something we are depending on to fuel the company in the near term." Another new asset for the company and its first big investment from its war chest includes a 17,300-square-foot facility in the BioPoint Innovation Labs in Durham. Cain says the facility gives Precision Biosciences commercial manufacturing capabilities. He says the company is currently up to about 160 employees, and he expects to end the year with at least 220. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. Prices rise as inventory remains low. Home sale prices continue to rise in the Triangle as increased demand continues to outstrip supply, even though the rate of growth appears to be slowing. That's the takeaway from a review of home sale data for the first half of 2019. Prices for homes sold in the Triangle are up more than 4% from last year, along with price per square foot, which rose more than 5%, according to data compiled by Beau Bromhall, a real estate agent with Berkshire Hathaway. But total sales in the region inched up only 1%, with Raleigh and Wake County seeing a slight drop. "We are enjoying a period of slow and steady growth," Bromhall says. The average sales price in the Triangle has risen 4.4% to $310,000 during the past year. In Raleigh, resale prices rose 4.2% to $312,500, and in Wake County, resale prices rose 4.4% to $320,800. Bromhall says increasing prices without subsequently increasing sales can often point to a market with more demand than can be met by the supply. This lack of supply is driven by too few homes being built and too few homeowners looking to sell. Bromhall said the median wage in the area can justify a $300,000 home, but rising material costs along with land and worker shortages are making it difficult for developers to make enough money on each new house to justify development. Meanwhile, homeowners enjoying low mortgage rates and increasing home values have every incentive to stay put. "The number of people willing to sell their home today is about one-third less than the last peak," he says. When there may be no end in sight to rising home prices, he says the growth is manageable and in keeping with what the region can afford. "We're frankly very lucky that prices haven't increased more than they have," Bromhall says. "We have grown pretty slowly and our prices haven't gone crazy." But as prices continue to rise, their acceleration appears to be slowing. Average sale prices in recent years have seen increases of 6 to 7%, Bromhall says. This year, it's around 4%. But monthly payments have gone down, according to data from Stacy Anfinson of Birch Appraisal Group. "It seems counterintuitive, but that was the case during the second quarter," he says. "The national 30-year fixed rate in January was 4.46%. In June, it had dropped to 3.8%. The June average was the lowest dating back to November 2016. North Chase Executive Center sold for nearly $40 million. A Georgia developer purchased the 2 North Chase office buildings off Six Forks Road in Raleigh for nearly $40 million earlier this month. JPB Holdings bought the North Chase Executive Center for for $39.75 million from the real estate arm of Principal Global Investors of Iowa. Principal bought it in 2013 for $11.65 million. North Chase features two office buildings totaling 176,620 square feet of Class A office space. The property recently saw $11.8 million of capital improvements and renovations. And the buildings are 95.6% leased, and tenants include Globant, Phillips Architecture, Go Realty, and the U.S. headquarters for MERS North America. New Glenwood Tower coming to Raleigh. Site preparation is underway on One Glenwood's $108 million sister, a 10-story tower with plans to transform the area into an epicenter of work and entertainment. The project, named Tower 2 at Block 83, is the second phase of Baltimore-based Heritage Properties' Block 83 project and the culmination of 3 years that the firm has spent acquiring and developing land in the South Glenwood neighborhood in Raleigh. It should be finished in January 2021. About the same size as One Glenwood, the new tower will feature retail and office space across 271,500 square feet, with plans to attract top talents in restaurants and retail. Vice President of Development and Acquisition at Heritage, Ryan Blair, says the company decided to move forward with construction given the high demand in the region and rapid success of One Glenwood. We're excited to start the next project and have experienced a lot of interest in the marketplace and have a few tenants ready to lease some space, he says. Raleigh Tower asks record price, $41.50 per square foot. A barrier has been broken when it comes to office space in the Triangle. Driven by a booming economy and shortage of new space, the Triangle office space surpassed $40 per square foot in the second quarter of this year. Kane Realty is asking $41.50 per square foot at Tower 4 at North Hills, according to data from Avis & Young. The tower is currently under construction and is 19% leased to IAT Insurance. Throughout the Triangle, Avis & Young has found rental rates rising, with average Class A office rates jumping 7% from last year to $29.42 per square foot. Class B office space saw an 8% jump to $21.22 per square foot. Avis & Young Managing Director John Linderman says the rise in prices have been driven by a rapidly growing economy with too few new spaces available to meet demand. And finally, Cary planners recommend rezoning Duke Health Campus. Duke University Health System's million-foot expansion in Cary took a step forward with the Town Planning Commission recommending Duke's request to rezone 70 acres. The commission voted unanimously July 22 to recommend the rezoning move forward to the town council, which is expected to make the final vote later this summer. If approved, the 69.96-acre tract will be rezoned to 13 pods with various uses. The site would feature 750,000 square feet of medical office space, 55,000 square feet of commercial uses, 100 hospital beds, 250 residential dwelling units, and 250 hotel rooms. The property is situated on Green Level West Road near the intersection with NC 540. According to the request, hospital use would only be permitted on one pod north of the road, and residential use would only be permitted south of the road. Now we turn to a page on business written by Hannah Lang. UNC students howl as Mexican restaurant threatened. UNC Chapel Hill's campus development plan has irked students as it targets a campus landmark many hold dear, their beloved Mexican joint. Cosmic Cantina, a hole-in-the-wall spot open every day until 4 a.m., is threatened by a component of UNC's master plan calling for the redevelopment of a strip of university-owned buildings on Franklin Street, including the one housing Cosmic. Other businesses along the way include the Carolina Coffee Shop and Johnny's T-shirt. The goal of the plan, approved in May, is to turn Porthole Alley, which connects campus to Franklin Street, into a better gateway to the university. Many UNC graduates remember the famous rolls and cheap eats of the Porthole, the bygone restaurant for which the alley was originally named. and Carolina has lost other legendary spots, most notably the Rathskeller. Carolina students who flock to Cosmic for a hearty meal on a budget are defending the spot known for tasty food they can grab late at night. The outcry comes just as students return to campus next month. In one Facebook group for UNC students, a user created the event called Chain the Entire Student Body to Cosmic So They Can't Demolish It. So far, 583 people have said they'll attend the imaginary event. When your kids ask you where you were when they tried to take down Cosmic, you can tell them you were on the right side of history, the event description reads. Join me in this show of solidarity with our burrito-making brethren, it says. I would die to protect Cosmic, one user commented. An online petition, Save Cosmic Cantina, has nearly 800 signers. Because no one else nutritious and affordable is there for you at 3 a.m., the petition's description reads. And these are the best employers in North Carolina, according to Forbes. What do SAS, UNC Healthcare, and Trader Joe's all have in common? According to a recently published ranking, it's happy employees. Forbes has released its first ranking of best employers by state, featuring 51 lists, including the District of Columbia, of companies where employees favorably reviewed their place of work. The top of North Carolina's list features some of the area giants you'd expect. SAS, Duke Energy, and Cisco Systems are the state's top three, but also some unexpected workplaces such as Earth Fair, a health-conscious grocer, and the Biltmore Company, which operates the Biltmore Estate in Asheville. Another highly ranked employer included is the Wake County Public School System, which ranked 25th. Rankings were determined by how well employees liked their place of work. A total of 67 North Carolina employers made the list. The list features companies from many of the Triangle's largest industries, including higher education, healthcare, and technology. In a state once dominated by agriculture and textiles, these industries have helped drive the Triangle's growth and apparently created some great places to work for local employees in the process. And now we turn to A Better World inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene. We start with a column written by Gene Tedrow, CEO, President and CEO of the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits in Raleigh. And Rob Madry, Director of Sustainability at the Center, also contributed. The headline, Nonprofits Need Unrestricted Funds Too. What if pizza shops had to manage their money like a nonprofit? Imagine a customer walking into a pizza shop to order, then saying they wanted to pay for only the ingredients, flour, the sauce, the toppings, and the cheese. In this story, the customer wants to restrict payment to cover the direct cost of ingredients without wanting to cover all the other expenses, the box, the oven, the lights, and the cooks in the kitchen. It is a humorous analogy that represents the nonprofit dilemma. This scenario happens all too often with nonprofits. Funders and donors, even knowing the total cost of service delivery, restrict the use of their contributions to direct program costs. This leaves the organization in a quandary and potentially open to a funding gap. Nonprofits must secure both restricted and unrestricted funds to effectively deliver programs and maintain efficient operations. Typically, restricted funds pay for direct services and programs, while unrestricted funds cover the operations that indirectly support the programs. Often, organizations seek funds to do their mission work without asking for or receiving the necessary unrestricted dollars to support indirect operations. Sometimes nonprofits won't tell funders their true costs for fear the funder will not give or continue to provide support. Some funders will only give restricted dollars, leaving the organization to find other fundraising activities to fill the gap. For example, this may be true if a nonprofit receives public funds, where there are specific guidelines to determine an acceptable indirect cost rate. Like any thriving business or well-managed pizza shop, it is important to know the true costs of service and product delivery. It is in everyone's best interest to understand and communicate this internally and externally. A healthy nonprofit has an optimal balance between its restricted and unrestricted funds. The board of this organization will be aware of how much operating support is needed to effectively deliver its programs, how and for what purpose restricted funds are raised and leveraged to support operations, and when there is an imbalance. With these full costs known and recognized, the nonprofit can communicate this with confidence to its funders. As nonprofits strive for best practices in financial management, funders and donors can also play a role to encourage healthy nonprofit management. One way is to allow or designate a portion of its project's grant to be used for general operations. Supporters, the board, and the staff have a shared goal to support the overall health of the organization and its work in the community. An imbalance between restricted and unrestricted funding creates a false tension that distracts from the mission and weakens both program delivery and the organization itself. When in balance, the organization is better able to effectively manage finances and focus on its mission. And in the nonprofit notes, GIFT launches $11.7 million capital campaign to fight addiction. A $1 million gift from a local foundation will kick off a Triangle Nonprofit's $11.7 million capital campaign to help North Carolinians fighting addictions. The A.J. Fletcher Foundation of Raleigh has pledged $1 million to Healing Transitions, which offers recovery-oriented services to individuals with alcoholism and other drug addictions. When we first opened the men's campus in 2001, the A.J. Fletcher Foundation provided office space and covered our initial startup costs as our facilities were being constructed. They have been with us since the beginning, and they remain committed to supporting us in this life-saving work, said Chris Budnick, Executive Director of Healing Transitions. We are thrilled that they are partnering with us again at this critical moment. We will never turn anyone away, but every day our staff faces the challenge of providing more and more services to people in need with little to no additional resources. The organization is hoping to raise enough funding to expand both its men's and women's centers by as much as 200 beds. Gift from BCBSNC to shed light on opioid epidemic. UNC-TV has received a $400,000 gift from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina to raise awareness of the opioid crisis afflicting the state. As part of a three-year initiative, UNC-TV will collaborate with the insurance giant to gather data, resources, and information about the ongoing health crisis. Using the strength of our tremendous storytelling expertise and our powerful statewide reach, UNC-TV will create an information initiative for all North Carolinians, said Travis Mitchell, Senior Director and Chief Content Officer of UNC-TV. The initiative will also focus on key audiences affected by the opioid epidemic. The initiative plans to create 25 digital short-form segments to be distributed on air and through social media, 3 full-length features, and 12 podcasts targeting youth. The content will also be disseminated on a webpage created for the initiative. NC Foundation invests in information and engagement about hurricane. The North Carolina Community Foundation, or NCCF, in partnership with the North Carolina Local News Lab Fund, has announced more than $300,000 in grant awards to support information and public engagement as communities recover from Hurricane Florence and prepare eastern North Carolina for future hurricanes. The organization says investing in accurate, trustworthy news and information is vital for the healing effort of North Carolina residents as they rebuild from the 2018 hurricane. We're proud of the partnership we forged with the North Carolina Local News Lab Fund and the willingness our partners have shown to address the persistent needs for access to information and for continued media coverage of disaster recovery, said Leslie Ann Jackson, NCCF's Vice President of Community Investment and Engagement. These grants are a tremendous asset to the communities in our state still recovering from Hurricane Florence and building resilience, she says. The grants will go to a wide variety of organizations, including the Core Sound Waterfowl Museum and Heritage Center, NLACE Latino, the North Carolina Farm Workers Project, and many others. And finally, Prevent Child Abuse North Carolina makes hire. A Triangle charity has named a new development director. Prevent Child Abuse North Carolina announced Claire Vesey is its new development director, effective July 22. She had been director of volunteer services for CQ Family House at UNC Hospitals, creating a giving initiative that raised $30,000 in just 10 days. I could not be more excited to join this incredible organization and work alongside such dynamic, smart, and passionate people, VC said. Prevent Child Abuse NC's mission has always been close to my heart, and I am looking forward to raising both awareness and support of this important work. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Here's a Way to Make Downtown South Work. When developer John Kane, entrepreneur Steve Malik, and real estate management company owner Billy Redman came to our offices a few days ago to talk about the $1.9 billion Downtown South project, it was easy to notice the excitement and purpose in their voices. What was not clear, however, is whether they feel convinced Raleigh and Wake County are buying into their plan. Briefly, this is the plan. Kane and Malik pledged to buy acres of land just south of downtown to develop multiple office buildings, retail centers, and hotels. But the city and county have to finance the building of a multi-purpose stadium that could cost in excess of $350 million. Simply put, the government, through the usage of the hotel-motel tax revenue, would help finance the stadium and private industry would build the infrastructure around it. On build-out, that would mean millions of additional dollars in property taxes for Raleigh and Wake County. As it stands right now, I'm not sure if the plan will pass. We shall see. But after talking to several people in the business and civic community, I am surprised no one has talked about an alternative scenario. The Centennial Authority, operators of PNC Arena, want $200 million from the same hotel-motel tax revenue pot to make improvements to the arena, which is home to the Carolina Hurricanes, NC State University's men's basketball team, and several other entertainment shows. The city and county planners recommended to the Raleigh City Council and the Wake County Board of Commissioners that the arena should get $200 million over 25 years. Instead of trying to upfit a 20-year-old arena with new gadgets and additions, why not commit to build an arena where the soccer stadium is planned? So, taking a cue from how Nashville, Tennessee got the money to build its soccer stadium, let's explore this. Build a new arena in downtown South. Cost will be about $550 million. NC State approves such a plan. Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon fronts $50 million to get the project started, just like the owners of the Nashville soccer team who committed $25 million up front and millions every year. The Centennial Authority remains the landlord, collecting part of the naming rights and rental revenue from tenants to operate the facility. Raleigh and Wake County get a portion of that revenue pie on an annual basis. Land owned by Kane, Malik, and the group will be leased to the authority in exchange for future credits. Additional land right beside the new arena will be reserved for construction of a 20,000-seat soccer stadium. Kane starts building offices and hotels as the arena construction starts, and commercial activity begins revving up the economic engine. Once the case is made that the development is working, Malik starts the motion for a soccer stadium right beside the arena. Fiscally speaking, the pitch becomes more effective. Now, to the financing. Raleigh and Wake County agree to finance the majority of the construction of the arena. NC State must agree to pour a portion of the money through its booster club, and Dundon's $50 million could be in the pot as well. While much of the hotel-motel tax revenue could be used toward the remainder of the financing, tax increment financing, or TIF, also would be an option to cover the difference for the local municipalities. Currently, if our government wanted to commit the dollars for PNC Arena and the new soccer stadium, it would mean a commitment of more than $500 million. To an unproven soccer stadium model and an arena that is old and likely to be obsolete 10 years from now, to me, the alternative sounds more appealing as Raleigh and Wake County would then have a true sports, entertainment, and commercial complex in an area clamoring for redevelopment. It is not going to be easy to bring everyone on board with such a plan, but executing a bold vision is never easy, and we must try. And we also have another column on the Viewpoint page written by Ford Worthy, who is a partner and senior advisor at Papa's Ventures. Why gerrymandering should matter to businesses. Gerrymandering, the art and science of manipulating the boundaries of legislative districts for impregnable partisan advantage, may be the most consequential business issue in North Carolina today. Curiously, though, it is not on the North Carolina business community's agenda. The current legislative agenda for the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce, which often speaks for business in North Carolina, stakes out positions on education, healthcare, transportation, taxes, capital and investment, all worthy pieces of the foundation for a strong economy, but nary a word about how we choose those who determine the policies that become law, nor is redistricting reform a stated priority for the chambers of commerce in Raleigh or Charlotte or Catawba County or Kinston or for any other such organization that I'm aware of. Yet, when I speak privately with individual business leaders about our current way of divvying up the electoral spoils, there is broad recognition that how we choose those who govern us is vitally important, and there's widespread agreement that our current redistricting system is broken, badly. That's not to say there is agreement about how to fix the system, or even among some, that it should be fixed, but it is rare to encounter the view that our current way of redrawing district maps after each census, where the politicians get to choose their voters rather than the other way around, is the best we can do. The whiteboarding conversations I've had over the past several months suggest that the business community is ideally positioned to make the case for fixing the gerrymandering problem. Business folks tend to prize accountability. If a senior executive or an employee, supplier, or lender doesn't perform, the underperformers know they will be replaced if they don't shape up. At a minimum, they understand that when the boss is unhappy or shareholders are upset, they better listen well and come up with a good explanation or a plan to do things differently. A legislator whose district has been drawn to withstand even wave elections doesn't face that same pressure. Once elected, a safe seat legislator tends to pay attention only to his or her base voters, whose support is often all that's needed to win the election that really counts, the party's primary election. I've spent the past 22 years in the venture capital business evaluating early-stage biotech companies in search of capital. One of the first questions I ask is whether a company's managers and employees have an important stake in its future success. And we'll stop there, but the article goes on to promote the FAIR Act, a bill that would ban legislators from using voter information, their tendencies, to draw up district maps. You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.